Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi lads, thanks for tuning into the podcast again. Don't forget to like and subscribe and head over to the Patreon to contribute and help us out. Thanks a million and enjoy the podcast. Hello everybody and welcome back to the Two Irish podcast. I am James Leonard, joined by my good friend Timmy
Lamb. Hi everyone.
Roman is on the deck. Say hi, Ron.
Hello,
Roman. Ron got a haircut and also thanks to everybody on the Patreon. This week we have two guests. I'll introduce our newest guest first, Amory Quilligan. From Limerick.
Yeah.
And my wife, Gillian Butler, from Churchfield.
Hello, everybody, again.
So, look, we'll come to you, Gillian, because we kind of know a little bit about you. But for yourself, Amory, do you want to tell us who you are and where you're from?
Yeah, so my name is Amory Quilligan. I'm from Newcastle West. And I am a social care worker. So I graduated in Limerick Institute of Technology. So I work for rehab care, so that's supporting young adults from residential living into independent living within the community. I work for Tipperary Rural Traveller Project as well, so that's supporting travellers. I'm a community support worker there. I volunteer. I'm on the board of management with Bedford Row Family Project in Limerick, so yeah. That's where it's supporting families and people impacted by imprisonment. And I'm on the Traveller Equality and Justice Programme here in Cork with Davy Joyce and Maria Burke as well. And what else do I do? I'm in the Traveller Graduate Network as well, so that's with Leanne McDonough and a few other travellers where we support other travellers throughout the country to get through education.
Yeah.
Where do you find all the time? There's a lot of groups there.
There's actually a bit more, but I'm like, that'll do for now.
Yeah.
But, she sent him an email beforehand with your list.
Sorry,
But you say you work for Bedford Row and you're still involved there.
Yeah.
They're very supportive of us on the podcast. They always comment and they show us a lot of support. So hello to everybody in Bedford Row.
Yeah.
First of all, around the working with the young people, it sounds like it can be a difficult job.
It depends on the attitude you kind of go in to the work with. I suppose just to say, and I don't want to frighten anyone now that might go into this line of work, but when I first started working for rehab care, so I was working with elderly men and women with disabilities and mild learning disabilities. So for a lot of it would have been elderly people that would have been put into industrial schools or Magdalene laundries when they shouldn't have been. You know, they might have had a very mild learning difficulty, but they became institutionalised. So then those institutions closed down. And what rehab care did, they set up houses all over the country. These houses are absolutely stunning. They're amazing. And where the individuals could come out and live independently. So really what I would do as a staff member, just supporting them throughout their daily living. And that could be anything like from, you know, going to the hairdressers, going shopping, you know, it was always very important that they have their life outside of rehab care, their friends, they meet up with their family, their activities. So you go to the pub like and things as well. It'd be great crack. But I remember when I first went into it, I was saying, like, you know, it was grand. It was brilliant. And I suppose, do you know, I'm not actually going to be modest in this, but I am a fantastic social care worker. And I know I am a good social care worker. And that's not from my grades or validation or anything from college. But when I would pull into the house, I'd pull into the drive and I'd hear the lady saying, the lady with the red car is here. Today is going to be a good day. And I, honest to God, lads, it really, do you know, yeah. would
that's
move
better
you.
Than any degree that's you can
amazing.
Get.
Any degree, any honours. But I loved it. And when I went there, I was only supposed to go there for, in my head, I was going to go there maybe for 6 weeks, a couple of months. And I'm there now almost 3 years. But I remember like my baptismal of fire, I was working with a group of men one night and we had a new man had transitioned into the house. And like a staff members, like it was very important that I understood his needs and his triggers, you know, and to make him feel safe and comfortable in the house. And I remember I was there one night and I could hear my work colleague saying, which, like, I couldn't take in these words because I didn't know what was happening, but he was saying, Anne-Marie, the shit, the shit, the shit. And I was like, what? I was looking around, you know, coming up through the hall. And next thing, the individual had got so distressed and he was a smear and he fired his feces at me. And I remember, like, it went into my face and my hair and everything. And I was saying, Jesus Christ,
oh,
what am I after getting myself into? And like, for a finish, like, this was like I was in Vietnam. Now I was coming up through the hall and I was ducking and diving and... I remember, like, I was coming to the end of the shift and I was like, nah, I'm not coming back here no more. Like, I couldn't do this work. But my sister is a social care worker as well. And I rang her on the way home and I was saying, Leanne, I can't do this kind of work. I'm not built for this. And she said, Emery, you need to get a grip. She says, go home and go for a shower. She said, it's not the end of the world. And it was, and it wasn't the end of the world. And she was like, look at what doctors have to do. Look at what nurses have to do. And she said, you need to get over your ego. Now, she said, this is about the gentleman and you have to support him. She said, you didn't meet his need and he reacted. And she said, you have to meet him where he was at. She's actually my baby sister, Leanne. So like, I took an
bit of tough love. Like,
she did, yeah. And, you know, it was the best piece of advice that I could have ever probably got in life. But I love the work. And I know we speak about boundaries and attachment and stuff like that. Like when you're working with people, like I'm in love with the people that I work with. Like they're like my family. I spend so much time with them, even through the whole of lockdown and everything where it was so difficult for everyone. Like they really took it on the chin, you know. We'd learn an awful lot, an awful lot from them.
The one thing about social care, I'm a social care worker too, you know. I work residential and in those jobs that are not so glamorous, but that you do because you're the love of it, you know. But it's not rewarded like it should be. Do you know what I mean? It's very undervalued and underpaid work for the amount of hours you do, the stress and strain that you're put on a shift. Would you agree?
100%. And I think kind of, I was saying to Gillian earlier on, one of the main reasons as well that I stayed there, like I have a manager, Aisling Hagen. I don't even have to say this now because I'm leaving in a couple of weeks and I'd be pure lonesome leaving them. But she's one of the best managers around, you know, like the service users, their voice is paramount and their needs come first. So she is very strict as well in relation to supervision. So we get supervision once a month. It's not an option. You have to do your supervision. Yeah. And if there's anything going on, so she has a really strong team. And you know, if you have one, like in any team, if you've one team member that's going to go against the grain, it disrupts everything, you know, but she manages that equilibrium. Like, you know, she's really good. So I've learned, like, no matter what situation you go into, you're always learning, but it is an undervalued job by society. And even when I look at it, like how I got into this work was I worked in accounts for years. I never did this kind of work. I went back to college as a mature student. But my grandfather got diagnosed with dementia, and my grandmother on my other side of the family got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And at the same time as well, my aunt that looked after my grandfather or lived with my grandfather, she had cancer and it had gone to her brain. And I remember with my grandfather, his biggest fear, he was going to go into a nursing home. You know, that was his biggest fear. So I did a FETAC level 5 care of the elderly course in the evenings after work. I had a brilliant, fantastic manager as well in the accounts. So I stood a FETAC level 5 course and I was speaking to all these amazing women that were caring for family members like at home. And I never realised the pressure and the stress that comes with it. So, like, as a social care worker, yes, it is undervalued and maybe we're not supported or recognised for the kind of work that we do. But whatever about us, like, I have a team of psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, managers around me for carers at home as an individual family carer. How we treat carers in Ireland, you know, it's an indictment. Like, you know, it's just so wrong.
The amount of money they save the state.
And they have no one. Like, I supported somebody that was very close to me as well for a couple of years that was experienced mental health illness and would have psychosis. And I remember even being in those situations where, like, going to bed at night, I'd be working off of 2-3 hours sleep a day. I was absolutely exhausted. You know, people don't understand the stress and the pressure that you're on when you're supporting somebody at home on your own and the rest of the family or even friends within the community don't chip in to help, you know, that kind of a way. I don't know how people do it long term. Like, you know, they get no holidays. It's a 24-hour job. It's 7 days a week. You know, and dirt is your tanks for it. You get no tax credits. You know, there's a young man back in Kerry. He's on Twitter. Michael is his name, or Michal. He was a teacher. He's now caring for his sister and his mother at home. He had to walk away from his paid employment into earning maybe €200 a week. No relief, no support throughout lockdown. Like, that's a hero.
Yeah,
you know, and those people don't get the recognition or the support that they deserve.
No, so look, well done, because you spoke really passionately about that, and it's great to give them acknowledgement. I think one thing COVID did, especially at the start of the pandemic, was highlight the importance of social care workers and key workers, because it, like, when all of them services was closed, it just showed like how many people actually rely and services like that.
Yeah, but I just want to bring us back a small bit now, because I don't think people really have got a view of who you are, firstly, right? You're a traveller. So just to explain, because I was listening to about your sister as well. Your sister seems like a really strong individual as well.
She's amazing, yeah.
We'll probably get the two of you on at some stage down the line. Be good. But I just want to go back and just bring it back, how it was maybe for you growing up, being a traveller, young person, how it was academically, because there are struggles for travellers academically growing up, how it was for you, and just tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, we can see how really articulate you are as a person, because you're very, very, very good, and I can see your sense of just goodness through your work, and I can see how much you really, really care for the people you work. So if you just want to go back a small bit and just talk a little bit about your own kind of upbringing and education and how it was, because it'll be very important for whatever young traveller women will be listening to this, they'll get some inspiration from whatever you have to say.
Thanks, Timmy. So I'm a traveller. I grew up in a small village just outside Newcastle West, let's say, called Castlemahon. So where we grew up, there was about like 20 houses. And beautiful. It was just a little village. And this is why I get really irate when people say social housing doesn't work, like, you know, or, you know. There was about 20 houses there. It was just a real working class area. Where we played was the fields. It was built on fairy forts, you know, like, so when we went playing up in the fields. We'd make cubby houses in the ditches, you know. The neighbour threw out a fridge. We'd bring the fridge up. We'd bury it into the ditch, hang a few curtains. You know, that was our childhood, like, you know. So it was very, I had a very beautiful upbringing, you know. And I suppose my mother and father, my mother was 17 when she had my brother George, so I'm the second eldest. So I always tell people that I am very privileged, and I grew up with an awful lot of privilege in life. Mightn't have been privileged through finances, but I had a very stable upbringing. You know, my mother and father, they didn't drink, they didn't smoke. Like, and throughout all my family, the children always came first. My grandfather was that way as well. So we were the only travellers. So we never knew any different, you know, and for us, let's say my father would do worked the markets. My father always worked two or three jobs. He worked the markets. He's a musician. My mother worked in the hospital. You know, we never went without. Do you know, but nobody really kind of had, everyone had the same. Do you know, it was nobody was rich, nobody was poor. Do you know, that kind of way out in the road, like we were always the same. And I suppose I never really noticed any difference in being a traveller until I went to secondary school. So when I went into secondary school, I'd say I got bullied. I mean, people would say the word knacker and tinker and stuff like that, you know, or whatever. My first time hearing it was four class, all right, but nobody knew what the word was. I didn't know what the word was, and I was just like, sure, he's a mug anyway. Do you know that kind of a way?
Was there many travellers in the secondary school?
In the first secondary school that I went to, no, there wasn't. But then what actually ended up happening in the first secondary school was I ended up getting bullied by a bully. He was just a bully. He's actually a lovely boy. I chat away to him now, like he's the grand old young fella. But, you know, it was just, you know, he was just a bully. Like, yeah. He probably had stuff going on in his own life. Like,
kids,
you know.
Kids are kids. Like,
kids can be very cruel, though.
That's kids it. Can be cruel.
Yeah. Kids can be very cruel. Yeah. Yeah. And they don't understand. I suppose a child doesn't really understand what they're saying.
100%.
Do you know what I mean? It's when they get older and when you become an adult. It's a different ball game then.
Yeah.
You know, because you are responsible for what's coming out of your mouth.
That's it, 100%. Yeah. And then, I suppose, this young fella, anyway, he used to give me an awful time. And
I probably fancied you as well.
Could have been, girl. Could have been.
You know, I tell you now, you could have fancied you.
I think, and that's how boys behave. They start hitting you and poking you and kicking you. And they actually do like you.
God help you, if you know? Had a crush on you, you'd be going around black and blue.
Oh, I knew that was coming up, girl. I walked into that one, girl, didn't I?
But, Les, I might get a husband out of this business. Bait to this.
It's a sign of affection.
Oh, God.
But anyway, he's a grand young fella today. But
he's a lovely man, yeah. But I remember, I suppose I was sensitive, didn't let's say, or whatever, and I was the only one kind of... And I internalised an awful lot of that. Mm. So then one day I was on the bus and lads, he spat in my face. And I just went home and I said to mum and father, I'm not going back to school no more. I was about 15. I just didn't fit. Mm. And it wasn't, I'm not going to blame the other students or the school or whatever. I just didn't, it was a more middle class school. Mm. And I just didn't feel like I belonged there. So then my parents I got into a DESH school. So while the DESH school then, when I went in there, there was every kind of individual in there. We were all equal. I fit there, you know, and that's where I started to flourish in as a young woman, you know, as a teenager. I started kind of coming into my own and I made amazing friends. But kind of in the DESH school then, we never had talks around, you know, like my neighbour, Helen Graney, she used to babysit us and she worked in the factory. So where I lived, there was a chicken factory as well, like where I lived. So like we all went working there like at 13, 14. Do you know, you just lie in your, you lie in your birth certificate. Yeah. You get like the Easter holidays, the summer holidays, like whatever. So my job was like tying chickens, God help us. I was about that height. It was probably slave labour, child labour. Yeah, but you know, I belong to flipping chickens. But that's the way the neighbourhood was. All the older neighbours looked after us. So we had like social capital and human capital as well, you know. So I used to work in the factory and Helen Graney, she's passed away since now, but she used to babysit us and I thought there was nothing like Helen Graney. She was stunning. She was absolutely gorgeous. And she worked in the office. So in my head then, I wanted to be like Helen Graney. So that was our kind of line of thinking. Yeah. You know, we weren't thinking about... going on to become doctors.
Yeah.
Do you know, we just didn't really have those conversations. And then, God help us, my father didn't, there was never any pressure on us to, I had no boyfriends anyway, but I'm not going to say that was true choice. Like, I flourished late in life. I tell you, I was an ugly duckling. Tell you the truth, like, it wasn't from the one to trying, I suppose. But, so I never had a boyfriend, like, or anything like that, you know. So, but we were always told you had to get the leaving cert. And my father's thing was, like, kind of, like, the social welfare wasn't an option because his thing was if you're on social welfare, the state own you and you'll never own anything. You'll never be independent. Mm. Do you know, you'll always be under compliment to someone. So we always, so there was that kind of work ethic there, and just to get the Leaving Cert. But when I was in school, God help us, my parents were paying for me to get grinds, and I had dyscalculia. It never got diagnosed.
What's that?
So basically, it's like dyslexia. I've mild dyslexia, but dyscalculia is whereas dyslexia is with words,
yeah.
Dyscalculia is with numbers.
Oh, okay.
So I can't, you know, even though I worked in accounts, but I didn't get diagnosed until so late. But why I was able to work in accounts was, like, obviously I'd be able to do percentages and use calculators and a spreadsheet and things like that, but I had the gift of the gab to bring the money in.
Yeah.
So I actually ended up working in accounts with a fella, Kieran. He's the salt of the earth as well, but he wouldn't be as sociable as myself, but he was a genius when it came to figures. So Kieran would do the figures, and I'd manage customers then to get the money in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, you survive, don't you?
Yeah. But so, I've heard of... Gillian's father is a traveller man, you know,
yeah.
he can't read.
Yeah.
But you get very, like, how do you navigate life? You just creative ways around it, you know what I mean? Just lateral thinking outside the box, and you manage it.
And you know what, I suppose, as you just said that there, I just got a flashback to, we were going to Dublin there many years ago. We were going up in the lorry, and he was telling me to look out for signs, but because I could read and write, I wasn't taking any notes of the signs. I just, you know, just wasn't thinking of it. And the whole way up the road to Dublin, he killed me the whole way up the road, because I was getting distracted with this. I was at the music. I was at things. And you just forget that when people can't read or write. Like, it's devastating, really, for them. Like, and their independence and their confidence. And
It's
such a basic thing to have. And it's very hard to imagine us not having the basic ability.
And, like,
to
read. In school, like, I mean, I left school at a very young age. You know, like, we have different stories. I left school at a very young age, but I was so happy that I came away with that piece, that I was able to read and write, you know, because, again, and it's not just my father. I have a couple of siblings now as well that can't, that the reading and writing isn't great.
Yeah.
And has prevented one of them from actually progressing in a career.
100%, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's
father,
sad.
Yeah, my father, as well, like, he would have finished school in primary school. And he's a musician, and so he has a band, you know, like, there's six of them in the band. But I remember when we were younger and the boys used to be calling, you know, and they'd be practicing the music, let's say, or whatever. And my father would say, I'm rewriting out them songs there. I'd be writing out songs for the boys, do you know, because I suppose my father probably didn't want to give it to say. You know, I never knew my father had struggled with reading and writing until later in life. But what actually happened was... he ended up like that. He was a great man. He did the markets. He used to do mobile video. So do you remember, like, we'd have videos instead of DVDs or whatever. So my father had a mobile video van. So he basically kitted out, shelled out the back of the van.
Oh, yeah.
And it was all videos.
We used to have a video man as well. Remember the video man?
The DVD. Yeah.
He'd drive around with the videos in the boot of his car.
That's
and
it.
Rent them out for
a few days. Jesus, they were happy old days back then.
They were brilliant. But my father then would bring one of us with him. Do you see? Do you know, like, and but there were brilliant life skills that we got as well. So they say my family, my father did the markets as well. My family still do the markets, like street trading. And, like, it's important, you know, we speak about education. Like, education, third level education isn't to be all and end all.
It's not for everybody.
No, it's not. But we got such amazing life skills, transferable life skills from an early age. Like, we go to the markets, we'd only be playing really in and out of all the stalls, do you know, kind of. But we were meeting people of different religions, different ethnicities, you know. So it was very rich upbringing, and it was very happy. You know, all
it
our
sounds aunts. Like it was very happy upbringing.
Yeah,
it does. Sound
and
like
you know,
it.
Even with the music, like, all my family are musicians and singers, so we can all sing. And even that's something.
Can
even
you sing
you
as well?
Might give us a song.
I
here.
Do.
Yeah.
I sing.
Oh,
yeah,
we get a song at the end.
Well, no, I won't sing here now, lads, because I am my mother's daughter. Now I will say that. Now my mother doesn't sing either, but I can sing. But I'd be the worst of all the singers. But anyway. Yeah. But, do you know, for us, like, growing up, everything was done around music. All the family gatherings, do you know, christenings, confirmations, communions. And even now, like, with my nieces and nephews, like, my nieces, they're in primary school. And they think my father, they think granddad is famous. And they don't understand how the other children don't know granddad songs. Do you think, like, and he does, like, the live streams and everything. Yeah. And, like, Zara and Eve and Faye, they're, like, 4, 5 and 6, and they'd be saying, sure, do you know this song? And they'd be singing my father's songs. And they think their friends haven't a clue. So it was a lovely... It was a lovely upbringing. But I ended up going on to third level. I was working in accounts. I went off travelling to Australia. I moved down to Cork there one summer. Just talking now about being a traveller. I moved down to Cork one summer to work down at the Kingsley Hotel.
To Kingsley.
Yeah, and I was staying in the Crow's Nest. I cried a river every night, lads. You'd swear to God now, I was after moving 100 countries away from my mother and father. I nearly died of lonesome below in Cork. And there was nothing keeping me there. You know, I was learning how to do fine dining. But there was nothing keeping me there, but it was in my head. Mm. I would say, I'm not going to give it to say, I can do this. You know, that kind of way. Yeah. And then I went over to Australia as well. I don't know how I came out of it alive, because the biggest mug, I was so green. I hadn't a clue what was going on. You know, I just took everyone like at face value, and I got myself into some hairy situations now where everything was just going over my head, because we were wrapped up in cotton wool. Do you know, which was grand in one way, but in another way, I didn't really know what was going on in the world. Do you know, I was so closed off, like, and it wasn't until I went to Bedford Row, I started seeing all these like beautiful human beings, people coming in, and realizing then how much privilege I had. And you know, sitting down chatting and thinking, I could never survive.
But even when I started working in homeless services, like, everybody knows my story, you know, everybody knows me knows my story, knows me. But I had it easy in compared to some of the people that I've come across, you know. And I think, like, how in the name of God are they alive even? Yeah. The resilience that some people have. Yeah, they might be homeless and using a lot of drugs, but the fact that they're not dead is unbelievable, considering the experiences they've had. And you would see it, and you would have seen it too, Jillian, in Cork Lions, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the people that are make up the prisons and people in prison watch this.
Yeah.
You know, and they get a lot of judgment and a lot of flack, but they're the most resilient people you'll ever meet in your life.
Yeah.
You made a very good point there as well about being wrapped in cotton wool. You know, that happens an awful lot. And I suppose if you do wrap your kids in too much of cotton wool these days, and when they do go out into the world and they see, they can be took advantage of, let's just say, and they could be very vulnerable as well, because they don't understand, you know, the way things work. Whereas we grew up in the midst of all the madness, we were streetwise, you know.
But that has its flaws in its downside as well, do you know what I mean? Because
it comes with
the streetwise, like, comes the chaotic lifestyle.
You lose your innocence very young,
children
in working class areas and traveller backgrounds, like, this. For some, not all, but for some, they grow up very quickly, you know, because they're exposed to much more. And I think for, I was working with this guy, and middle class person, lovely middle class school for the kids, and he was very pissed off one day because this working class child in the class was after telling his child that there was no such thing as Santa and the Tooth Fairy and all these things. But sure, the working class child was streets ahead in terms of, like, the savviness. The middle class child was very green, as you put it, you know, innocent, the way a child should be. But listen, I would say, like, it's not the child is only the child is innocent.
You're conditioned. Yeah. You're just conditioned to whatever environment you're in at the time.
And children will adapt. And I find, I was saying to Gillian earlier on, like, I was working with one traveller woman. So I actually came into this kind of work then through two ladies, Bridgie Casey and Mags Casey. They're from Limerick, phenomenal women. And I remember Bridgie Casey, she had an article one day. 12 members of her family, they've buried through suicide. They're a traveller family. 12 members.
I've had a few as well from my family from suicide. Yeah. My uncles,
absolute trauma, like,
it's,
you know.
It's devastating.
Yeah, and she was saying, they were saying to me one day, Emery, the children, like, I didn't get it, you know, and they were saying, Emery, when the damage starts when the children go into school, that's where the trauma begins for the children. And it really, it is, like, you know. And I remember she was saying one day, we had one school alone where 20 of the traveller children were diagnosed with ADHD. And in my head, I was straight away, oh, sure, yeah, they're anti-traveller anyway. That school's clearly anti-traveller. But I didn't understand anything about trauma or being trauma-informed or anything like that. So kind of like you see a lot with professionals. And I think the system in itself, they're always like the adverse childhood experiences, you know, the ACEs, they're looking in on the family. Mm. They're monitoring, they're surveilling the family, the child. The problem is inside the house, you know. They're not looking at what's happening within society. The wider community and society, or even what's happening in the school to these children. And like for an awful lot of the traveller children are born into homelessness. Like our definition of homelessness in Ireland is completely inadequate. You know, it doesn't cover like what actual homeless is like. If you're living in a house that's not culturally appropriate, if you're living domestic violence, if you're living in a house without access to running water, sanitation, you know, or toilets or electricity or anything like that. And if a child, like that stress starts developing in the womb in a child, you know, if the mother is stressed, that those stress hormones are passed on to the child through the womb, and that impacts the development of the child's brain. And then the child is born into inadequate living conditions through no fault of the parents. It's not that the parents don't love the children or can't care for the children. The parents have no control over their living environment.
And the funding that's been provided has not been used to provide traveller accommodation.
Yeah, so it's down to social policy. Yeah, you know, this is a choice, like this is neoliberal. This is the type of world that we live in. And it does come down to capitalism and stuff like that as well. And then these children are born and they're going into school. Like their behaviours, because the child is diagnosed with ADHD because the child's brain is trying to protect itself, is trying to regulate itself. So when the child gets stressed, the child will shut down. You know, it's like fight, flight or freeze. And that's, we're punishing little babies. We're punishing children in a school. A child that's experiencing trauma, that's trying to protect themselves. Like I saw there maybe 2-3 weeks ago, for a teacher to send a report home for a 5-year-old child that lost her father, traveller child that lost her father, in big red writing, 2 out of 3 or 2 out of 10, 1 out of 10, behavioural, you know, wouldn't sit still. This teacher did not want to recognise or acknowledge that this child was after burying her father.
But that's what we were talking about earlier, Anne-Marie, on being trauma informed. It's not rolled out enough. It's not inside in the schools. Yeah. It's not in the education centres.
Can I give you an example of that? What you in an adult, right? Of the actual freeze situation, right? When I did get into education, right, I had this mechanism built up to deal with any form of stress or violence or anything that I couldn't deal with, I had the freeze, right? So when I went into education, right, maths was something I really, really struggled with. And when I get anxious, I'd freeze. I just blocked off from everything. My brain didn't work. I got stressed, but I could not think beyond anything. Nothing made sense to me on the sheet.
Exactly.
And I would go into my own sense of unworthiness. I was stupid, you know, I wasn't able, you know, all these different things. And it wasn't until I got trauma-informed that I started to realise what this was, right? And meditation, which was another thing, and I started sitting with these feelings of that really strong feeling of anxiety. You know, it's just stress. Why can't it?
It's about trying to regulate yourself as well.
Yeah.
When you get into that kind of, like, I know for me personally, I can completely identify with that, because as a child, and I speak for myself, I was almost conditioned that I wasn't good enough. I was stupid. I was this. I was that. You're no good. You're going to go nowhere in life. And I internalized all of that on top of everything else that was going on around me. And when you, I suppose, when you get into your adult life and you don't have those skills of self-regulation, and I can still, James, witness to that, I can still have my little episodes where it's like, no matter what you say to me, there's a block. I can't hear it. I can't let it in until I come out the other side of it again. And that could be 5 minutes. It could be 10 minutes. It could be 3 days of wrecking his head about one particular thing. But when you talk, like you talk about being a trauma informed, when you become aware of how you are in that situation, we're listening to The Power of Now, that book on Audible. All of those kind of things helps. Yeah. It certainly helps me to sit down, calm myself, and realise that it's my thinking that's gone bonkers here. Yeah. And that if I bring it back to the present moment, I'm actually okay and everything is okay. But it's hard when you're in that to bring yourself out of it.
It's very hard. But you know, when you were speaking about that child there, I'd be thinking about myself, you know, in school as well, you know. I remember, and I spoke about this before, I remember in secondary school I found it very difficult, very a lot going on at home, my personal life. The teachers didn't really care, didn't want to know, and they just, it was all negativity, you know, like. But I remember I was always good at English, always had a good vocabulary, but always well able to write. And I remember one exam I did, I got like 18% in maths and I got 82% in English. And both comments was very disruptive in class.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter what grade you got.
Yeah.
It was always the same negative comment.
Yeah.
No, nothing taken into account what was going on for James. Just, it was all negative. So then you would be like, I'm the fuck about school. I hated school after that, you know. And then you end up leaving school thinking that you're stupid, that you're not able.
You internalise it. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It kills your self-esteem.
100%.
Do you know, if a teacher pulled you up in that, James, at the beginning, right, and just pulled you aside and said, James, how are you getting on? Are you okay? Is there something going on for your home? You know, and you probably turned around then and said, yeah, do you know what? This is going on, blah, 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 whatever. Your whole environment within that classroom would have changed.
But I think that's why I did okay in primary school. Because in primary school, you have the one teacher for the whole year. You build a relationship with that teacher. And I had good experiences in secondary school. You have a teacher for 40 minutes. You have another teacher for 40 minutes. You have no connection with the teacher.
And the other issue to that then is the numbers in the class. Yeah. Do you know, like, when there's large numbers, I work in an education centre at the moment, and we've small numbers in the class, small enough numbers. So you can build the relationships. You can have the bit of banter. You can have the bit of crack. You can also see when the child is upset or the student is upset.
Yeah.
And if there's maybe something going on for them. But you can build a relationship. But if you're sitting down with a big classroom of 30 or 40 children, that can be very difficult as on the teacher. Do you know what I mean?
Even in secondary school, I had only a class of about six of us. But we were completely labelled and judged. Like the messers, the people that couldn't learn, the people that didn't want to learn. So the teachers were coming in, it was like free class for them. There was nothing expected of us. And they took, you know, to read a book or whatever, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you know, but I remember even in primary school, we'd have had a lot of travellers. Because in where we're from, there's loads of travellers. Loads of travellers in houses, loads of travellers in the hot side.
Yeah.
So we'd have always had travellers in class. But I remember in primary school, let's say if I was in first class, a traveller guy could come into senior infants the year below, but he'd do his confirmation before me then. I always wonder, like, how do traveller young fellas come in after me and finish before me? But it's like they're escalated through quicker.
There's an expected outcome.
It's like they're trying to get them through as quick as they can.
Yeah, because they know the expected outcome is that they're going to leave.
Yeah.
They're going to leave early. They're going to be gone. Yeah. So it's like, let's get them through as quick as we can. Get them over the line for those type of things anyway. That would be my understanding of it.
That's still happening today. That is. And like, we have one school where a secondary school where all the traveller children were brought down to the sports hall. And I'm informed by the principal that when they turn 16, they can leave school. That's today.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there's an expected outcome for travellers.
The expectations are so low.
Yeah.
So I work with traveller students all across Munster. So it would be like Tipperary, Limerick, Kerry, Cork, or wherever. Where we have traveller students in junior cert. Traveller students in leaving cert getting pictures of horses to colour in. That's happening today, like, you know. There's a disproportionate number of traveller students put on a reduced, informal use of the reduced timetable where they're finishing school at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock during the day. These would be children, you see, let's say, the teachers, the principal would say, oh, they're behavioural, they're bold or whatever. the same children I go into, they're amazing for me, but I treat them with a bit of respect and a bit of dignity. And I believe in them, you know, like, and children will respond to that if they feel safe. Yeah. Children will, it's like that one good adult and that positive reinforcement, but the expectation is so low. Now, like, sometimes you go into some schools and I'm telling you, you meet teachers and you know these teachers are changing lives. Mm. You meet principals that will go above and beyond. And you'll always know, like, it's the principal that will reach out to you as opposed to you trying to get in the door to build up a relationship. Like, I never understand why a principal doesn't want to build up a relationship with me. Because I'm not going in out of malice. I'm going in good faith
trying to help the situation.
And not to judge either, because I completely understand there are challenges from within our community.
Absolutely.
So it's internal and it's external. But why are we always looking in? Mm. Why are we looking at what's happening within society? And I really have a big problem with our children being put on medication for ADHD. When really, if we just maybe adjusted the situation, the environment, the learning environment a little bit to meet the need of the child, the child mightn't have to go on medication. Do you know, I'm not anti-medication now, don't get me wrong. You know, I'm not a professional or like in that regard to make a diagnosis. But like, why is it that I'm going to children that are saying to me, I'm not a teacher or I don't work in education. I'm a community support worker. Miss, where's our books today? Do you know, if I come onto the site, Miss, where's my pictures? Or I've a little 4-year-old lad, you run away with her, she's gorgeous. And every day she's at the end of the drive. Where's my homework? And I'd have her little homework in an envelope. Sure, I only print stuff off, you know, from the learning thing off the computer. And I put 2 or 3 crayons into it. And then, and did you correct my homework from last week? And the teachers are telling me this child don't want to learn.
Yeah.
But that's a cop-out. Yeah. And I suppose it's very important as well, while I would be focused on traveller children. This has been done to children from hotels that are homeless children in hotels. This has been done to children from that are living in direct provision, children with disabilities. And also as well, there's a big difference in the approach I find from the school in relation to a child that comes from a middle class background experiencing trauma to a child coming from a working class background experiencing trauma. It's trauma if it's a middle class child, but it's they're being bold if they're a working class child. You know, and that's wrong. And that's how children then get streamed and they will internalize that. And even I find, I don't know if you find this now with, if you ever heard of Basil Bernstein, you know, the language codes in the education system. So you have the restricted codes and the elaborate codes. Mm. So like the elaborate codes would be the codes that the education system is designed for. So academic language, So when a middle class child would go in, they know this language, they understand it. But like with the traveller children, like they're so little value on our language, our working class children and how we speak, do you know, like that somehow, because it's not how we speak isn't a reflection on our academic or our intellect. We speak how everyone around us speaks. Yeah. So the children now, like, and it's beautiful to hear them use it, like, you know, they'll say the keen, you know, so keen is traveller word for house, you know, or they say subal, you know, or they say watch the fiend or the bjorn. But they're corrected then in that, like in school. Yeah. But that's our language. And we should be able to speak it and we shouldn't be made feel embarrassed about it, do you know?
Well, I think a big problem as well, and you raised there, is the curriculum is designed by middle class people and it's reflected.
And it's outdated.
Like, but even for working class and traveller young people in school, we never learned about traveller culture in school. We never learned about our own culture.
Exactly.
You never thought about the, like most of the people in our areas would do trades.
Yeah.
Not all of them would trade. Never heard that, the value, that being valued in the curriculum, you know. It might be different these days, especially in Desh schools, you know. But back in the day, it wasn't like that. You'd learn about Irish poetry and Shakespeare and all these fucking stupid things that you never want to learn. You never go, not stupid, no, they're good. They're valuable.
What
value are they going to add to your life, really?
Exactly.
The education doesn't reflect where you're from. The clothes we wear, the music we listen to, the language we speak, the activities we partake in when we leave school, the stuff our mother is doing, the activities our father is doing.
Yeah.
That's not, we're not seeing any of that in the curriculum.
No, and it's not celebrated in any level, really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
Do you know, listen, I suppose what we don't want to do either is kind of start going down the route of saying too much about teachers, but
because there's great teachers out there as well, Jimmy,
curriculum is given to the teachers by the government.
What my point is really is I don't think teachers are actually informed enough about the difficulties some of the kids are going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's actually getting worse. All the different, there's a lot more kids with dyslexia. There's a lot more kids with different ADHD. Forms of disabilities. ADHD is a massive thing.
This day and age, to me, there's no reason why teachers or anyone in that kind of a profession, not just teachers, social care, any profession like that, where you're working directly with people, young people, adults, vulnerable people, whichever. There's no excuse in this day and age why people are not trauma informed.
Exactly.
There's loads of resources out there for people.
Yeah.
You can either go off and there's days trainings that you can do, or there's loads of information on YouTube and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean?
It would change everything.
I think the problem there is it's not mandatory, and it's very much down to the ethos of the principal in the school. They have a lot of autonomy, and some schools are great.
Exactly.
And some schools aren't. There's a guy there, Dave Cashman. He runs an Educate Together primary school in Southside in Cork. But sounds like the ideal school that will probably be a model for more progressive schools. But then in other schools, in more middle class, I'd rather be upsetting no middle class people because they all watch podcasts too. Mm-hmm. A lot of them do. But there can be a denial about the traumas in the school, like, oh, sure, we don't need a youth club in our area, we don't need a guard youth diversion plan, we don't need a community drugs worker, we don't need mental health talks in our school. There's a denial about that, you know.
And the fact as well, like trauma is trauma, you know, and when you look at the adverse childhood experiences, sometimes now I don't like using the ACEs because I don't like to just look in on top of the family, or the child and blame the child. You have to look at societal level and social policy and stuff like that. But like with the ACEs, if there was a mental health, poor mental health in the family, if there was addiction, if there was imprisonment, if there was the death of a parent, if there was domestic violence, these things happen in middle class families as well.
Yeah.
You know, so trauma informed is to benefit all the children. But like that as well. I would stress that, Les, there are some teachers now, and honest to God, they will move mountains for the children.
Yeah. A lot of teachers watch this podcast as well.
Yeah,
you know, and we're going to get the principal of Knockinheeny Secondary School on with a teacher, Phil and Yvonne, so they'll be coming on. Hope to get them on around September.
Yeah,
you know, so to give. To make it balanced as well.
That's not a bad idea. That's actually a very, very good idea.
Yeah. I'm his biggest fan. I swear to God, I'm like, where's Dan today? He's always on the podcast. I'm sorry, like him for that.
No, he's great.
But he is absolutely amazing. But they're meeting, his team is meeting the students where they're at.
Yeah.
And they're not trying to change the children. They're trying to support the children. And that's the difference.
Because there's two different kinds of teaching a kid.
Yeah.
And I'm saying this now from my own experience, because I was somebody that could not sit in a classroom and listen, never mind retain information, because I lived my whole life caught up in adrenaline and survival mode. But I loved going into the woodwork class.
Yes.
I loved, when I wasn't messing, art, my two biggest, if the teacher gave us an exam in the class, the two biggest results were woodwork and art. I was brilliant at it. And we should look at that at a really young age.
Yes.
Look at the kids, which ones are going to really develop a little bit more in a practical world, a practical environment, where we have a school where kids will learn. And you're not singling anybody out. You're doing this for the kids, because the child does not. Some of the kids just do not want to sit inside in the classroom trying to learn stuff that they cannot understand or retain, because they're after missing 2-3 weeks of the lead up to this classroom.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking from my own experience. But if they go in and they're being taught how to make a little cross or a chair, something that's really going to help them develop when they leave school, I think we should start looking at that, them kind of schools a little bit more. And I'm sure they are out there, but there needs to be more.
Yeah.
There needs to be more, you know. And it's very important. Sorry, James, I'm finishing this. It's very important that the parents of the kids as well get involved in this.
That's key.
You know, because they're the ones who have the power and the authority to say, do you know what? I understand it needs to be explained to them first by the school and the teachers. And they need to be able to give permission then for a child. Because what you're doing is you're taking a lot of pain away from a child.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they don't fit into a certain environment and they don't feel comfortable, they're going through a lot of stress. But if they go into that classroom and they're mindful, right, completely mindful. Because some of the best times in my life I had carving.
Yeah.
Because I was completely ingrained in the carving because it was practical. And I think more work needs to be done and getting kids that need the practical work and away from the academic, you know.
We had Joe Slattery on here a few weeks ago.
Oh, he's brilliant.
Fellow Limerick. He works with horses.
Yeah.
But imagine having Joe as part of the school, you know, where, like, wouldn't that make traveller young fellas and young girls feel like that this is where you know, that this is there for them and their culture is valued and all the kids can learn about horses and, you know, because it has obvious therapeutic value.
Yeah.
Then.
Do you know what? And I suppose I'm very mindful that I don't want to get on the road of bashing the government or representatives
bashing,
for all this. I know, but I am. I'm very mindful of that. We don't want to turn into that either, but I remember when
that's
I was
the other talk of the Shack podcasts.
get up the back and you're on the
table. I remember when I returned to education as a mature student, I went back and I did a play psychology and social studies. And look, education is a powerful thing, as we all know.
Yeah.
Do you know? But as part of that, the social studies, I was reading a book and it was around discrimination and racism. And I remember reading it and I was shocked at what a Fianna Fáil, it was a Fianna Fáil councillor, one of the comments that he had made about travellers, you know, that the shotguns should be taken out to him.
Fianna Fáil, the shotguns at the ready. Yeah.
Get them out of the country because they're not country fellow men, basically.
Yeah,
and I remember, I remember reading that. No, I was well aware of the racism and discrimination, of course I was. But when I seen it
so blatant
on paper, black and white in front of me, that this was coming from a politician that's supposed to be a representative for all of Ireland, I was shocked. And as the years go on, I suppose, and, you know, I got more educated as I went along and got more experience along the roads. You can see why society is as it is and why travellers are boxed off and they're not getting what they need and we're not getting what we need. Because when it has to come from the top down.
100%.
It has to come from the top down.
Yeah. You can see how it happens. Like, I suppose I always bring up, this is just for me personally, and I do take it very personal. And like that now, I'm not anti-government. Do you know, I'm not anti-government anyway. I'm left, but I'm not anti-government. Like, I know Leo Varadkar is a lovely man. I know Micheál Martin, they're lovely men. They're lovely people. Their politics is shit. Do you know, that's the reality. Like, and Fianna Fáil and Fianna Gael voters need to take ownership of that. And this is why now their children are going without housing.
Yeah.
But now, because their children now can't get housed and are struggling, are leaving the country, now the surge is coming and the urgency, which I'm delighted, but it's coming very late. But if people want to know what's going to happen to their children, if people want to know what are the outcomes for the children that we're rearing, like 4,000 children in this country in hotel rooms. Like, we have thousands of children in direct provision. We have thousands of children in halting sites around the country. But if they want to know what Irish society is going to look like in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time, take a good look at our community, the traveller community.
Mm-hmm.
When you take a person's identity from them, it comes down to Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
When you take a person's right to a safe accommodation, all of that has an impact on mental health. And that's why we have anxiety and poor mental health among our young people today.
Mm.
Like, the suicide level among travellers, 11% of traveller deaths are caused by suicide.
Mm.
You know, and that's been reflected now. That's mirroring now back into mainstream, the general population.
But when, even like even when it comes down to employment, 80% of employment employers won't accept travellers.
Yeah.
90% of the general population won't accept a traveller into their family.
Yeah.
Like, it's complete exclusion and discrimination and racism.
Yeah. I think something that you spoke about there as well, Gillian, was I was thinking about, you know, Gordon Allport, American psychologist, he has like a scale of prejudice where it begins with avoidance. And then it begins with antilocution. I think that's another fancy word for it. But it's about you're avoiding them, you're speaking negatively about them, but it gets progressively worse. And the last one is extermination. Now, I'm not saying we're going to have extermination, but it has happened in other jurisdictions.
Exactly.
In Bosnia, has happened in Germany, has happened in the China, and in other countries. Like, well,
and when you have a Fianna Fáil councillor making statements like that, right, that I just mentioned.
Yeah,
like,
but that's how it starts. It happened
that's
with
how
Trump.
It starts.
It starts with the rethoric, the talking, you know. But them words aren't empty words, because they lead to the violence and all that other stuff down the line.
Yeah. What happens to somebody that makes a comment like that?
Absolutely nothing when it's done to travellers.
I'll tell you what happens. They get rewarded by Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil. We have
there's no consequences from to me, and that's the sickening thing about it.
Look with Peter Casey. As soon as he went to the anti-traveller rhetoric, that man was very, like, could very well have got voted in, like, and he played Trump politics. But, you know, I was just saying there, what really upsets me is, they say, everyone is like, oh, get an education. Education isn't the key when you're a minority that experiences discrimination or racism. I went to a function, a mental health function set up by Max Casey in Tipperary. And it was about travellers with mental health. Every expert in the country was at this function. There was doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, everything. So the majority at the event, it was held in a hotel, were non-traveller professionals. I'd say if there was maybe about 20 of us, as in travellers, you know, at the event. I was there with Dr. Cindy Joyce, Dr. Bridget Quilligan, Megs Casey graduated from university, Bridget Casey graduated from university, Breda Harty, myself. We got refused coffee after the event was over.
Why?
Just because of where you are.
You got refused a coffee
after paying for the, like, TRTP had paid for the event, and the manager in the hotel turned around and he said, "I think I've done enough for ye people." That went to court.
I hate that terminology, ye people.
Yeah, that went to court. Do you know?
Yeah.
I remember Bridgie came over and said it to me. I couldn't believe it. Like, when she first said it to me, I thought she was joking.
The audacity of it, like,
yeah.
I can completely relate to that because of my own situations in the past, like, and I get really angry with people like that as well.
I know, but you know what, to me, with respect to you, it's very different when you're coming from a minority.
Oh, I understand 100%.
It's embedded in Irish society, and then with the consequence of that, it's embedded in us, and we constantly feel we're not good enough, that there's something wrong.
Well, I'm telling the two of you, know, you are good enough.
Yes, and I know today I am, but I'm just saying for others that, you know, like, and I can go there myself with not feeling good enough. But it's a different experience. Can I take from your experience?
Can I take it down a criminal justice slant?
Okay.
Because we're up to an hour, but we'll go for a few minutes longer. But we're independent, we can do what we want. But there was a case in Cork a few years ago. This traveller woman went into the guard station to get passport for a kid. The child was about 3. The child was put into the pulse system.
Yeah.
And it was a whistleblower exposed it and everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Travellers are way overrepresented in the prison system, you know. A small portion of the overall population, 20-odd% of the prison population. Can you talk to us a little bit about the challenges that traveller men and women face that mean that a lot end up in prison?
Overrepresented.
Because when I first went into prison, the first time I ever went into prison, on A3 where I went, was all people from where I'm from. You know, and I know they're not all bad people.
Of course.
And on B3 was all travellers, and on B2 was all Africans and Polish. They're not all bad people. But there's certain, you know, social policies and other things at play that divert us down into those routes.
I suppose, I'll just give you a quick example now. I won't go into it in detail because I know we're caught for time. But just to give an example, my baby brother, Patrick, very, very quiet child growing up. Absolute, like, you know, never a geek out of him, just very, very quiet child, very good child anyway, whatever. He was going over, he was only 13 years of age. He was calling over to his friend's house one evening. My father said to him, "You're not going till you've the dog walked and you've your homework done." His friend was after getting a new game for the PlayStation. Before we knew it, Patrick went out for the walk anyway. Before we knew it, two members of An Garda Síochána had my brother Patrick dropped back to the house. Child now was on his own. They had broke a bone in his body, in his arm. They had picked him up, brought him back to the house and said that they got reports that he broke 20 windows in a vacant building site. We knew the child. This child was very quiet. You know your children, you know your siblings. Well, I remember the guard was saying, I was like, what's wrong with this innocent boy? I was looking at Patrick, like, what the f-? I was looking at the child saying, is there something happening here that we don't know about? Because if a guard tells you a thing, you believe a thing. Now, to keep in mind, both sides of my family are members of An Garda Síochána, so I'm not anti An Garda Síochána. The traveller side of my family and the settled side of my family, my mother's not traveller at all. So both sides of my family are in An Garda Síochána. What we went through with An Garda Síochána, the ombudsman came down. The ombudsman were absolutely amazing. They went above and beyond. They were gentlemen. They told us when they were taking the case, we didn't prosecute, it was the DPP prosecuted, not us. The guards received no call to the Garda station. No window had been broken. No crime had been committed. They took him, two grown men, for a laugh, if you ask me, or throwing their weight around town, two young new Gardas. They took him outside of the town into the countryside, down into a field. By the way, is that they took the child out there that they were pursuing, a youth with an asthma, and they took our Patrick on a high-speed car chase. When that went to court, like, it was obviously the child, there was no crime committed, like, they just picked him up. When that went to court, this was, and I think back, like, of Terence Wheelock that died in custody. This was the time, lads, of Morris McCabe when all this stuff was happening. When that went to court, like, we weren't even entertained. That was just ticking the box exercise. That guard was absent on the day of ASP training, so he didn't know how to use the ASP.
Yeah.
And a 13-year-old child that was doing nothing wrong, they picked him up. So I don't know about, like, I'm not going to turn around and say it was racial profiling or ethnic profiling. I'm not going to say that's what it was, but I'm more certain that it wouldn't have happened to the doctor's son. Do you know, and I will say that. Yeah. But anyway, that definitely happened. Not. So, like, and like that now, lads, as well, there are good guards out there. And by God,
did you say you have a family member that's a guard that he's traveller as well?
Yeah.
I'd say that's very rare.
It is very rare,
Do you have one on your mum's side as well?
On my mother's side as well, my mother's brother and my cousin. So my mother's, my uncle and my cousin, are guards.
I'd love to get him on the podcast.
I've never heard of a guard. This is, as long as I'm alive, I've never heard of.
So on your mother's side, who's settled, and your dad's guard side, who's travelling, you have both guards on those sides.
Sorry, Timmy.
Sorry, you're fine. I'm just here. I never heard of it. It was like the first time I seen a Chinese guard walking down Patrick Street.
Yeah,
I had to look twice as well. So, but it's great that our country is really coming around to just.
But we need more.
Integrate.
We need more of it,
across
all boards, education everywhere.
But that type of profiling is not going to help.
And that is there, and that happens now, to children from working class areas. It depends on your address, lads, and it depends on your name, And the truth be told, it depends definitely on the colour of your skin, because, as a traveller, I can hide my identity. We speak about Goffman with spoiled identities and stigma and stuff like that. And there's a process where it's called passing. So let's say if you come from a working class area, you'll internalise that shame and that oppression. Where if you might change your accent, so that's a form of passing. You might speak differently. You might try to hide your religion. I might try to hide my identity as a traveller, but that's all internalised, and that impacts on a person's mental health, and that be LGBT and stuff like that as well. But to get back to your question about the prison, I did research there. I worked with, I didn't do the research. Dr. Sinead O'Malley did the research. She's a social worker in Galway.
I was actually on that group myself, but I had to excuse myself from it because we had some stuff going on. We were have to bring the baby into a house. We were have to foster the baby at the time. So our whole house was turned upside down for a period of time. Yeah. But I was initially involved in that project. Yeah. She's great, Sinead.
She's absolutely amazing. And in her, when I was working on that with her, what I noticed was, I'm not going to say the findings now because Sinead's just putting all that together. And but what you could see was the traveller mothers. So it was traveller mothers and non-traveller mothers. The traveller mothers, the interventions from the state, like Child Family Agency in Tuzla, were very early and very, very heavy on the family. So the family was effectively being surveilled. The parenting was being surveilled, you know, like... children being taken from, a lot of the traveller children being taken from their homes because social workers went into the wrong house. So they took those children as well. Even though they acknowledged that they were in the wrong house, but it was because they were travellers, so they took them. So they would be in and out of care, foster care, going back home. So it was a huge disruption to their upbringing, where then they would come out of foster care. So I suppose you're not supposed to exit foster care until about 18, but the traveller children were exiting foster care like at 13, 14, 15, and nobody was coming looking for them. They were going into homeless hostels. They were trying to survive. Homeless hostels probably mixing up, you know, with they wouldn't have been streetwise either, getting involved in crime, maybe a bit of addiction, trying to survive, you know, because they had no one to guide them, you know, and stuff like that. And we know that's a cycle, that's a revolving door. So it's this, and this is when the state's looking after the children.
Yeah.
This is when the social workers are looking after the children. But it's very easy for the social workers then to turn around and look at the mother and father and blame the mother and father. But it was the state that, like, one woman was taken, she was 13 weeks old, taken from her family by the state, taken, sent back. So then they'd end up in imprisonment. So there's an awful lot of hidden homelessness, you know, and there's no stability.
And when children are taken from their family, like...
The bond is broken.
The bond, and, like, it caused so much upset.
There was a case a few years ago of a Roma child. Remember the Roma child?
The child was blind.
The child from the house, he was blind, and he didn't have the same. Can you imagine that happening in a middle-class person's home?
It wouldn't happen at all. And the thing about it is, and I can't remember now if I said it, because we were chatting earlier on as well, but do you know the way that like if a child is stressed and a person is stressed, the cortisol is released. Like travellers die, traveller men and women die 15 to 16 years earlier than the general population. But they're born into stressful environments. Yeah. They're in a constant state of fight and flight.
Yeah.
So this cortisone is a stress hormone that's been released into the body. That's building up then in the body. This is why travellers are dying from... heart disease. It's not just because of diet, it's because of stress, because we know when scientifically and biologically, physiologically, if that stress hormone is continuously released into the body, it impacts the immune system. Do you know, it impacts the development of the brain, it impacts the gut.
And bowel cancer was a huge thing as well, because I remember when I worked as a traveller health worker in West Cork, we would have been delivering trainer around that stuff.
Yeah.
Bowel cancer is a huge thing as well within the travelling community, being diagnosed or undiagnosed and dying early.
Yeah, you know? And asthma. There was a study in America just released recently, and it was the impact of racism on black women, where the black women, the more frequently that they had, the more experiences of racism that they had, the more they were diagnosed with asthma. So you've that, you know, you have the racism, the anti-traveller prejudice, and then on top of that, then you have living conditions where we still have. I'm working with families. We're in a pandemic. We're 18 months in now. We're just kind of coming out of the pandemic, lads. I'm working with families that are going to the toilet in buckets.
I know, it's shocking. And I've seen on Twitter there recently, and I think it was Rosemary. I was after flagging it as well, but because of the uproar, I suppose, in Dublin with the mess around the streets and the URA, like going to the toilet and all that jazz, the council were after providing these...
Portaloos.
Yet we have traveller families... in desperate situations, the funding is there for them and they're not receiving it.
That's it, yeah.
It's disgraceful.
Yeah.
Well, we'll finish, James, we've just seen there, we take off and leave this one, you know.
I know, yeah.
But you know, two passionate women.
They're unbelievable, and you know, you made a great point there about the African American women, black women, you know, because there was, I was looking at a seminar by Gabor Maté on a different thing, and he was saying the telomeres, which is your DNA of African American women, are shorter than those of Caucasian, and they die 10 to 15 years younger than the white women because of the stress related to racism and the stress related to their kids, young black men on the streets of America, and the stress of knowing that your son could be killed or just shot by a police officer at any time over there for just walking the street.
I think one of Gabor Maté, and I must mention Sharon Lambert too, because even though Sharon is a psychologist, she's always very vocal about ACEs and the limitations of it, and like not taking into account social policy and structural forces at play, and are always blaming the individual and the family. So it's important. And Gabor Maté always speaks around, you know, structural issues and geopolitical issues that impact upon people's physical health and the cortisol response and everything. But we could go for hours, but we won't.
Can I just mention one thing? Because I was going on about education is. Do you know the last recession, the traveller training and education budget was cut by over 83%. So like where we are now at the moment, 28% of travellers leave school by primary school, the boys. Only 13% of travellers finish secondary school, and only 1% of travellers go on to third level education. So that's why like people say, oh, why don't travellers get jobs? How do they end up in imprisonment? When these are your life situations and this is how you, this is what you're up against, it's very hard. It's very hard to progress in life when you're faced with that. But when the traveller budget, the traveller education budget was cut, that was done overnight. You know, there was no supports put in for our children. So our children now are being put on reduced timetables. They're not getting their supports that they should be getting in school. But I'm working with Megs Casey in TRTP at the moment. And like, I'm very excited about what she's after coming up with is we have now a programme for 10 traveller women to go on to third level education. Brilliant. And these women are from within the community. They're going to become educational mentors, you know, so they're getting a proper qualification to mentor the children. Because our children, and I need to make this very safe, our children are not safe in school. And the thing is, we had the industrial schools, we had the Magdalen laundries and things like that. People did that, and those people are still here. You know, that, you know, like those, the people that do that are racist, are prejudiced and are bullies. And people like that do not just disappear. And while there are very good teachers, very good principals and things like that, we can't deny that that line of thinking is still inside in school. And when a child tells you they're not safe in school, they are not safe in school. And we have to start listening to the children. So that's why I'm glad for Mags that she does have this program coming up where it is shown the children that their parents are continuing in education, but also that we can educate the children in a safe environment until such time that it is safe for our children to stay in the schools again.
We'd love to speak to Mags sometime.
Mags
about
is amazing.
That.
She
was suggested to us as well by I think it was the probation officer that we had on.
Mark Griffin. And her son Jack Griffin works in TRTP as well. He's a social worker and he works within the he qualified as a social worker. I work with him now and he works in the prison as well, and I have to say a gentleman and very informed, very well
educated. If he's anything like his mum anyway, he's from good stock.
Well, of course.
We have an uncle as well, Jerry, that worked in the prison. Another really nice guy.
He keeps me in line now and check as well.
They're going to kill us.
I know. What's your dad's name?
My father's name is Paddy Quilligan.
Hi, Paddy. Hi, Paddy. We know you watched the podcast on the ball, and hope you enjoy. Just your daughter did really well, and you raised a great woman.
And I just want to say as well, Paddy, thanks so much for the CDs for my daddy. I'm sure he'll be delighted with them. Big Elvis fan. So thanks a million for that. You're a star.
Oh, he'll be thrilled.
Are we sorted, so?
Yeah.
Thanks for coming down to meet us.
Oh, lads, thanks a million. Yeah.
It was great.
James knows all the Elvis songs from listening from over home. She plays Elvis all the time.
We're the same now, Les. We're all. Do you remember CMTV?
We'll continue this conversation afterwards. I'll see you later, lads.
thanks for listening to the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and don't forget to head over to the Patreon if you'd like to help us. Thanks again.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.